Welcome to By the Way, a half-hour conversation of topics that are of concern and interest to residents of Lancaster, York, and Dauphin counties. Produced exclusively for Hall Communications. Here's your host, Sue Sensenig.
And good morning and welcome, listeners, to this Sunday morning in October. You know, there's been a lot of work and a lot of talk in Harrisburg these days. They're back, they're working hard, and they're talking a lot. And one of the items that's been up for debate is the privatization of the state's liquor stores. And one local state lawmaker who's gathering public opinion on this topic is Representative John Baer of the 97th District, and he's with us here this morning. And welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Sue. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the public opinion on the topic of privatization, let's first lay out what we're discussing. What would the privatization of the state's liquor stores, which are now run by the PLCB, the Pennsylvania
Correct.
Liquor Control Board, what would this mean for the stores themselves, the customers, and the state?
Yeah, and if you don't mind, if I could just put that little bit of historical context to this. Pennsylvania is unique in that we're one of only two states that are completely control states, and in that we have ownership and control of both the wholesale and retail operations, and that is Pennsylvania and Utah. That's it.
And Utah makes sense.
Yeah, and I guess it does. And the remaining 48 states have some type of privatization to it. About 18 states have a kind of a hybrid between privatization and state involvement,
okay.
And the rest are completely free market. So just to put in context, that is what we're, you know, how we look compared to other states.
Okay.
What we're talking about here in privatization is actually looking at doing just that, privatizing both the wholesale and retail operations. And when you talk about this, often people immediately get a little confused in that they think, well, if we privatize it, will we be losing revenue? Often you hear, and sometimes you see it in editorials too, don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think we need to do for the listeners is divide into two pieces. On one hand, you have the people, the pensions, and the storefront side of things.
Right.
Really the people in the store side of the business. And then you have the taxation on liquor itself and the wine. And that's where you need to look at it. Where we get our revenue primarily is from the taxation on liquor. And that is about, I think last year it was almost $400 million. That's going to be reoccurring and continue to exist no matter what we do. The one-time money, and this is the part you hear people talk about, and you want to make sure you do this wisely and use the money wisely, would be the actual selling of the licenses to the wholesale and retail operators that want to do this independently. And that number ranges from like $1.5 to maybe $2 billion. We'll get an official estimate here shortly from PFM Consulting. They're doing a study on this.
Okay.
But that's the one-time money, and that's the money you would want to use wisely because once it's spent, it's not coming back. You will have licensing fees that will be renewed every so often, but not to that dollar amount.
Okay.
So there's two parts. But with this privatization is, one, we'd be liquidating that side of the business and getting that one-time money, but we'd also be reforming the tax laws on liquor itself. We would be getting rid of the $1.50 bottle markup fee. We'd be getting rid of the 18% Johnstown flood tax. We would be getting rid of the 30% markup on liquor as well. And, of course, then you have the 6% sales tax. So all said and done, right now we're marking up our liquor about a little over 50% before people end up buying it. So that we'd be getting rid of that and then going to a pure gallonage tax to make up the difference and to reform it.
Now, with the privatization, the employees of the stores,
mm-hmm.
Is the state currently paying their salaries and paying health insurance and benefits?
Yes, and right now we have a total of about 4,300 employees employed by the PLCB. And yes, they are state employees with state salaries, state benefits, state pensions, all that.
So with the privatization would then mean that the state would no longer be employing this amount of people. However, they would probably be able to continue their jobs with the private owners.
Yeah, and you hit the right point. And honestly, I know we'll be talking about lots of points on this issue. Of all the points that are made about the concern of going to privatization or where there might be impacts, this is the one that's most concerning to me and the most valid, is that you want to treat those employees fairly. They're good people. There's nothing wrong with the employees.
Right.
It's the business model that is not it's outdated and needs to be modernized. So we'd have to find a way to transition. And yes, in the bill, we have incentives to basically have them get a higher score so they could maybe be a state employee elsewhere, give them money to go back to school. But hopefully, I'm hoping some of these people will actually stay in the stores when they're taken over by the private operators. Yes.
And I think there would be validity, you know, a good reason for that. They obviously get to know some of the regular customers. Mm-hmm. And these people also don't need as much training in spotting underage and spotting people who probably shouldn't be purchasing large quantities of alcohol.
Right, and that's a very good point, because if you're a private operator and you're about to invest $1 million or more dollars for a license, you've just made a huge investment of capital, and you want to make sure you have good employees on the front line, because they are the face and the eyes, ears, the everything. They're the interface with the customer, and if they aren't doing their job, potentially, and then let's say there's someone gets a bottle of liquor that's underage, well, then you could lose your license and all that investment if you don't have the right people that are well paid and well trained up front. Mm-hmm. So I think the notion that some people say, well, now you'll have minimum wage workers. If I'm buying a store, I'm not putting a minimum wage worker up there in the front.
Right.
I want to make sure someone that's invested, that's interested, and can think that we'll make sure that we follow the rules.
You know, it's funny. I always find when I do go into a liquor store, it's or a state store, there's not a kid behind the register. It's always usually someone my age or maybe even a little bit older that has a little bit more seasoning under their belt. For the customers, let's look at this for a second. If we would privatize the state liquor stores, they would no longer be state stores.
Correct.
Which means, conceivably, they could be open on state holidays.
It's a whole new world. So if you've been out of the state and bought wine or spirits out of state elsewhere, and you saw what they were doing, mm-hmm. and you come back into Pennsylvania, as much as we have modernized our operation over the years, we're still stuck in the Stone Ages. So yeah, it's a very strong contrast. And if you look at what the bill is proposing, there's two types of licenses. You know, one is for your big grocery stores or chains that would be over 15,000 square feet.
Okay.
And for that, it's not like they're going to be blending into the grocery aisles or the regular store shelves. It's going to be a separate section within that store with a separate register and person working that to buy it. But yes, so you could theoretically you could be going to a Giant under this law and go to a section and buy your wine or liquor at that point. The other part is the B Class B licenses, and that's basically for the operators that are more like we have right now, that under 15,000 square feet.
Right.
And that would be, you know, pretty much the same it is now, but they could be free to do whatever they want. Operation, you know, in terms of hours, in terms of how they want to stock their inventory, to the layout of the building. I mean, yeah. I mean, you can be very creative. You can get entrepreneurs to be thinking in that mode and changing the business model.
Okay. This past week, on Wednesday, you held a public meeting with your constituents to discuss this topic. You were actually part, there were a panel of state reps, including Representatives Cutler, Ament, and Denlinger, all from Lancaster County. We've had Representatives Cutler and Ament here on the show, so we know Brian and Ryan, as I call them. What did you hear from residents in your district and in perhaps other districts that came to this meeting? What did you hear from them about this issue?
Well, one of the things that's going to be interesting in this debate, and I'll tell you why I think Lancaster County is so important, is traditionally Lancaster, when this has been tried before, has not been as, how do I want to say, maybe as excited about or even buying into the idea.
Open,
that we
should, accepting.
Accepting, yeah, whatever you want to say, as far as maybe that this is a good idea.
Okay.
The last three times it's been tried. But I think the times have really changed. And traditionally, when that has happened, you have the social conservatives, which I consider myself one, you know, a conservative Republican. They often align themselves with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and most incredibly, and the part that I find fascinating, big labor to kill the bill.
Okay.
Well, I think things have changed. Now I talk to constituents across the political spectrum, and even my friends on the social conservative side, and most of them seem to be pretty open about the idea that this is not a core function of government, that this is something that can be done better. And we get out of this conflict of interest where we're basically selling, or we're marketing, we're selling, we're regulating, and we're taxing and enforcing liquor. We're getting out of the whole marketing and selling part and focusing where we should be, which is the taxation, regulation, and strong enforcement of the laws. Mm-hmm. And so Lancaster is important because if we're on board, I think this makes this bill possible. It can get through. And that's why we wanted to do that. And, you know, what I've been hearing and what we heard last or on Wednesday night was that the overwhelming majority want to privatize. They think it's a good idea. Our meeting on Wednesday had about 60% saying yes.
Okay.
And I think the numbers are even higher when I've done this on emails and talked to people independently. So I think it's something that people are accepting and would like to see.
Now, for those who are maybe on the other side of this coin, and you talked a little bit about, you know, the very conservative, social mm-hmm. conservative side. But there are people who are not supporting this. What are their reasons, or what are they telling you their reasons are for not supporting the privatization?
Well, there's some people who don't want to support it because they think this might, there might be more increased alcoholism, although that I've heard very little of. What I've heard a lot of is this is not a moneymaker, that the system's working great, that you're going to lose money and leave the things as is. That's essentially the argument. And that argument is primarily coming from the unions that have a major vested interest in this.
Okay.
But I would ask them to step back and think broadly, because from their perspective, I think they're strictly looking at basically the membership, the salaries of their employees and their dues, and that this might hurt their hurt their organization. But in other states where you have a private operation, it creates a lot more jobs, both union and non-union.
Right.
There's union jobs in major grocery chains, union jobs in wholesale. So if the union is so concerned about jobs, I would say step back and look what other states have done. You'll still have union jobs because this is going to be a job generator and this is going to grow. And we also, under this bill, there's a lot more licenses available. So there's more stores out there for convenience sake than there was currently under existing law. So I think they need to not be so focused on their control and their dues and step back and think what this could mean long term for them. But I think they're being very short-sighted.
Do you think also by privatizing the system, it will maybe cut some of the traffic between, say, Pennsylvania and Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, where...
Absolutely.
You know where I'm going with the question.
Well, basically, we just had Chairman Newman, the former chairman of the PLCB, Jonathan Newman. He spoke to us this past week in caucus, and I think he said his estimate, I'm pretty sure this, was about 27 or 25% loss. Revenue loss for okay. people going across the lines, particularly in Philadelphia,
right?
Southern Lancaster, or you know, places that border Maryland,
yes.
Delaware, New Jersey. We're losing a lot of money there, and he thinks this would help solve some of it. But people are going over there because of selection and costs and inconvenience to a certain extent too. So, but yeah, it absolutely we're losing. That would be something to be addressed.
Okay. We're talking today with Representative John Baer, the 97th district in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Moving on to another topic that crossed my desk this week is the modernization of the prevailing wage law. I have to admit, when I saw this, my first reaction was, what is the prevailing wage law?
The prevailing wage law is a law that was established in 1961 to basically make sure that workers on publicly funded construction projects get the fair prevailing wage of the area. And what that's supposed to mean is the fair market rate. But what the reality of that means is the union rate. So what that has done over a period of 50 years is drastically inflated the cost of public construction jobs. So think of it this way. If you're concerned about your property taxes, that your local school district might be doing a building, well, guess what? That's prevailing wage. We think it adds at least 20% to all construction costs. If the state's building something, that's prevailing wage. If your municipality is repaving its road, that's now prevailing wage. So the bottom line, and from my perspective, it's a really outdated law that had good intentions initially, but it's been applied very poorly. And Sue, as we talk about, if you notice with me, a lot of these issues we talk about, for me, it's all about challenging the status quo.
Right.
I'm not a big guy about the status quo. I think there's lots of ways to move government into the 21st century to operate more efficiently, more effectively, and most importantly, give taxpayers a better return on their investment. And this is another good issue. Modernization of liquor stores absolutely is one. It's a no-brainer. I can't believe we even fight over this thing. But the second one is prevailing wage. You know, I think there should be standards across the board that provide a level playing field for union and non-union. So one of the bills I introduced in the prevailing wage package is a pretty basic reform, and it's called having a standard job classification definitions across the state. And for listeners, think of it this way. when you go apply for a job or you go to work for a company, probably the first thing they do is give you a job definition.
Correct.
This is what this is. This is a job definition that's statewide. So if you're XYZ company and you're going to bid a public job, you know what the definition of a laborer is. You know what the definition of electrician is, okay, or the sheet metal worker. And that way, and here's why it's important, you can make sure that you apply your bid appropriately, use the right rates based on what classifications you're using, job classifications, so you're applying by the law. Today, there is no standard statewide, it's by region, and it's not transparent. So what happens during Democratic administrations, unions sue the open shop saying they used the wrong job classification, okay, and if they don't abide by it, they try to get them debarred. This is about political gamesmanship and not what's best for Pennsylvanians. That's why a lot of the reforms we're looking at, my job classification. The second one, adjusting the threshold for what qualifies as a prevailing wage job. It was established in 1961 as $25,000. Guess what it costs today? It's still $25,000.
Oh, my gosh.
We want to adjust that to $185,000, okay, adjusted for inflation.
Right.
And the third thing is, a few years ago, under the Rendell administration, they decided to apply prevailing wage to all maintenance work on roads. So if your municipality has to do an overlay on your road or do minor repairs, at one time you could do that more cheaply because it wasn't prevailing wage. They apply prevailing wage. We want to fix that as well. And there's many others too, but these are very common sense things. They don't kill prevailing wage. They just modernize it and make sure it's a fair deal for taxpayers.
You know, as we're talking about this, the prevailing wage, we're talking about the PLCB. There seems to be a lot of things on the books, and you even mentioned the Johnstown flood tax.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff on the books, it seems, in Harrisburg that is, you know, was established 50, 60, 100 years ago. Would the average person, you know, your average constituent, be surprised at how much is on the books now that is antiquated?
I'm always surprised, and I've been doing this for a long time.
Okay.
Even before I went into elected office, my job with an accounting firm was to work with state agencies to improve their operations. And, you know, I think what listeners need to understand is once you adopt a tax or a law, it almost has, it lives for an eternity until someone challenges,
okay,
it. But whenever you challenge it, it's always difficult because once you have a new law, a new form of tax or whatever, you now have a constituency group. And once that you have a constituency group formed, they're the ones will fight you tooth and nail to ever make any changes, even,
okay,
if they make complete and total sense, if it's
right,
in the best interest. So that's the uphill battle as a lawmaker you have. And, you know, we talked about two things here. We talked about liquor store privatization, prevailing wage. They just happen to be things that are very unionized and that unions are fighting us on. But I find it absolutely wrong that we have such a small minority dictating to the majority. And for the liquor stores, for example, you have 4,300 employees dictating to the 12.5 million Pennsylvanians. For construction trades, dealing with the unions and the construction trades, you have them to be, depends who numbers you use, I say it's 18% of the construction workforce. They say at least a little over 20. Nonetheless, a small number dictating the rest to us.
Right.
And this is absurd. And if Pennsylvania wants to get out of the Stone Ages and start, you know, getting the modern, you know, getting back into the modern world and up where industry is, and also be a place that people want to locate, we got to put our blinders off and start thinking critically about how we can reform these things. So it's up in line with the 21st century, and it shouldn't be a battle. But yet, here we are fighting over little things.
Let's talk about something else, that a conversation with any state rep, no matter whether you're from the northwestern corner, the southeastern corner, no matter where you're from in this Commonwealth, I don't think any of my colleagues doing this would talk to a state rep without asking about Marcellus Shale.
Yep.
Now, I have to admit, I live in your district. And we'll talk later about some of the road construction.
You didn't tell me that earlier.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of the construction in my neighborhood, and some of those workers on those projects and how hard I found them working the other day. yeah. And I'm sure they have words for me, too. But How vital is it to the people of your district, the 97th? How vital is Marcellus Shale?
I think there's a great deal of interest in Marcellus Shale, and I think there's a great deal of concern. And I think if I had a guess and speak for the district, I'd say most individuals I've talked to or have heard from want something done in terms of, one, making sure we do this right, and so it's fair to the environment, but also to Pennsylvanians, but second, making sure we have some type of revenue stream from it that's helps mitigate any damage or impacts it might have on municipalities, the counties, or even statewide. So I think my district is in favor of an impact fee or a severance tax, and I think, you know, the sooner the better for most of the folks in the district.
Before the show started today, you and I were talking a little bit about Marcellus Shale, that there are in this area of the Commonwealth, you know, whether it's Lancaster, York, Dauphin, Cumberland counties, there are people who, while will not be directly affected by having, you know, this under their house, mm-hmm. Do have cabins up in the north sections of Pennsylvania, who would then be affected directly.
Yeah, we do have a lot of people that own land, hunting cabins, what have you, in that part of Pennsylvania where they're actually having these conversations with drillers. Do I lease my land? What's the fair market value? How long do I lock myself in? And listen, I don't deny that this is a little bit of the Wild West right now in terms of we're trying to get a baseline, trying to get established, educate people on what they need to know when they negotiate contracts. Certainly people that negotiated contracts early on probably did not get the fair dollar value for the land. Right. Those doing it now probably are, but it's complicated. And this is, I think the real fight, Sue, is going to be not if we have a severance or impact fee. I think that's going to happen. And from my perspective, as long as that is competitive with other states, when you look at our other taxes on the books, I'm cool with that. I think the real fight is, where does the money go? And we're going to land a pitting the municipalities, counties against the state to a certain extent. Because those who live in the areas where it's actually happening, they have a very strong opinion that the money should stay there.
Right.
Whether it be for the roads, for social impacts, for environment, whatever it may be. But there's also a strong group of folks, and some of them in my district, that feel that it's only right that some of this goes to the state coffers for, for the conservation districts, for conservancy, for legacy funds for environmental damage. And others think they should be used for education in other areas. So state police. So that's where the battle's going to lie. I tend to lean more towards keeping it local as much as possible,
right,
and or putting funds or dollars into funds that are legacy, that they'll be there when the industry no longer is, to help mitigate any damage.
Okay.
When you have a new revenue source, it can kind of be a drug. And I've seen it up there in Harrisburg after 5 years. When you have a new revenue source, it goes strictly to the general fund. There's 1,000,010 ways to spend it.
Right.
And once you get that addiction, it's awful hard to get off it. And that's the only concern I have, is being a conservative Republican. When you talk about fees and taxes, I don't want unfair fees, or I don't want a lot of new taxes, but I think this is one that's valid, but then we gotta make sure we're not addicted to it in terms of finding new ways to spend it. It needs to be for the purpose of the Marcellus Shale area, for the environment, and any mitigation of damage is done.
I think it's interesting that you mention education. Obviously, if we had been having this conversation 6 months ago, education was truly the hot topic.
Sure.
And education reform, and I think it's interesting that as we talk about a revenue source, education creeps in again. Is that area of funding, that little cubbyhole, mm-hmm. Is that an area that you feel is always going to creep into conversations when it comes to revenue sources?
Well, I think for the short term, yes, because education and welfare are the two largest expenditures in our Commonwealth. And up to this past year, they were the ones that grew without getting cut. And what listeners have to understand is, and one of the reasons this past spring was so tough, that Pennsylvania, like every other state in the nation, this is the first year we had no stimulus dollars, no more federal dollars. So for 3 years prior to that, we got about $3 billion a year to help offset our spending. And essentially, we were balancing our budgets on outside money to make it work. Well, that ended, and we went off the cliff, and this is the first year that we had to balance our revenue or our expenditures with our own revenues. And that meant we had to go into education and DPW a little bit, because there's nowhere else to cut. We, prior to that, particularly under the prior governor, I mean, he would beg, borrow, and steal from every line item to fund education, and that's great. Education is a wonderful investment. We need to be, you know, our children need it, and our teachers are a really valuable resource. But I think they were living in cloud nine in that they weren't being realistic about finances and where we were going, and that that had to come back. I mean, nothing ever just goes one direction. It swings back a little bit. And I think that's the hard part that a lot of people are having to deal with, because under the prior governor, I think he artificially inflated our spending in the education field. And I know there was cost analysis and they said we need to spend so much per child, but the reality is we just can't afford it. So I think as much as we can, we need to think about how we can get a better return on investment there and make better use of our dollars. So we still have very good teachers, but at the end of the day, try and do a little bit more with less.
You know, as you say, that as things swing one way, they swing another, it just seems that it's entirely a Newton's cradle.
Yep.
With those, you know, lovely little five balls that swing back and forth, and for every action, there is a reaction.
Yeah, well, it's funny. We had our talk back in April. I always do one right after, I'm trying to do one right after the budget address now. And my father had just passed away, and the very last conversation I had with my father was on education funding. And I shared with my audience that night, my father, before he went into construction, was a teacher for a long time in Manheim Township Schools. And he also was the first one to organize Manheim Township Schools Union, and he was the president of it. So people, when I tell them that, they're like, "Bear, how can that be?" Because, you know, I'm perceived as being anti-union. I'm not anti-union. I'm about fairness and about balance. And unions had a very good reason to organize back in the late 1960s, early 70s. They were not being paid fairly. They were not getting enough benefits. All those things. But what he and I were talking about right before he passed away was how the pendulum has now swung the complete other direction. Mm-hmm. And I would argue, you know, you hear the PSEA talk about, and they're very good with the grassroots, about how we're treating the teachers and the students. It's all about the kids. Well, there's some truth to that, but it's also about the PSEA's power and the perks and their benefits and everything else. And they've gone from being really the lightweight to being the heaviest. I mean, they're the 800-pound gorilla in the room. They are one of the largest lobbyists. They are one of the biggest groups that give money to legislators. They are intense. So I think people have to realize that, you know, they're really spending a lot of money and time on where we're going with public policy, and there has to be a balance. And as much as things were wrong in the late 1960s and early 70s, I would argue teachers and administrators are being paid very fairly. They have a very good life, and we have to come back to the middle a little bit, and you know, sometimes that's hard. So it's not that I'm anti-union. I'm about fairness to the taxpayer, and they've gone too far, and you know, it's going to swing back, and it's tough for them.
And in fairness, my husband is an educator in Lancaster City.
My wife teaches too.
Yeah. So yes, I know what you're saying, and by the way, I really like his insurance. that I will say. In the last moments that we have left, and this is a much lighter note, you and I last talked in April of 2010 when we talked about tax amnesty. At that point, you were pretty much enjoying being a state rep. Is it still fun?
I'm smiling, right? I've been smiling here.
Yes, you have been. Yes.
I love it. I was in consulting for a long time. I thought that was a fantastic job. But this is even better because every day is a new adventure. You get a chance to really affect public policy for the public good. And you can drive change. And at the end of the day, as much as I enjoy consulting and I was working with state agencies and school districts and what have you, I can only make recommendations. Here in this role, I can get input directly from my constituents and be the one that drives the change. And let me tell you, there's so many things to look at. It's not like we have a shortage of things to work on.
Right.
And so whether it be labor law to privatization of liquor stores, getting the issue of what is the fundamental role of government, what should we be in, there's a lot of other things I would call modernization efforts needed. You know, I've been working with Cheryl DeLozier in the governor's office to create an executive order to create what we call the Pennsylvania 2.0 team, a center for innovation and thinking where we go agency by agency and say, how can we update our operations? How can we be cutting edge? How can we save taxpayer dollars? And I could do this until I retire, probably. That's how much work there is to be done. I don't want to do that, but I want to go back to the private sector at some point here. But it's very rewarding, and I've enjoyed it, and I try to be very candid with my constituents and lay everything on the table and be fearless. I mean, I'm not afraid to take on the issues, and there's a lot more to do.
Representative John Bear, the 97th, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck. And folks, thank you for joining us today. And as I wish you each week at this time, safe travels.
By the Way is a production of Hall Communications. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on this program are strictly their own and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Hall Communications, its ownership, staff, or management. If you would like more information on this program or have a program idea, please contact Sue Sensenig at SUESEN@hallradio.com.